The following interview was conducted on behalf of the Oral History Program of the Washington County Museum and Century High School. The interviewees are
Phil Barnikoff, Marianne Barnikoff, and Bob Orme.
The interviewer is Catherine Tobiasen. The interview took place at the Barnikoff's home on Thursday, May 25th at 4 o'clock. In your opinion, at what point did students really become aware of the war in Vietnam?
Well, one of the things that where they really became aware, I think they were always aware of the war in Vietnam, but the thing that brought it home to true compatible color was that when some of the graduates, one year I can remember in 70, 71, and 72, when they were drafted and went to war, and then the next fall, many of them didn't come back, and we had funeral, we had a memorial service at the high school for several of them, and now it became a reality to them at that time.
And I would add to that, I know that the first class that I taught at Hill High was the graduating class of 1969, and two of my students volunteered and voluntarily joined the armed forces. And one of them was seriously injured in Vietnam, lost both of his legs, he stepped on a mine, he was a medic, and they came home. He, about a year later, committed suicide. And that was a tragedy of the war, and certainly his friends and people who knew him understood that.
You know, it's really, since really the involvement in the war actively in 64, a lot of the kids really, as well as adults, didn't understand the war. I mean, knew what was going on. They were aware that we were sending troops, and that was escalating. But really, after 64, when we really got involved, and you know, when we got into sending a lot of troops, and kids started realizing that the draft at that time, you had to sign up. And so the schools had to organize sign-ups for kids that are 18 years old. And that sort of brought it home. I mean, we really were put in a position under, from the Selective Service Board that we had to make sure our job was to make every kid sign up. And so they automatically started thinking, boy, this is a big deal. I mean, never before have we had to have kids sign up. And a lot of kids were going, as the other two have mentioned, and some were injured or killed very soon after going. I think also that kids then also saying, well, one of the ways to get out of the war, besides going to Canada, which we didn't have any that we knew of, was to make sure you were registered for college. So we had a real push, you know, at the same time they were signing up, also a big push to get registered for college and try to get a deferment as a student. So that was one of the things that happened to the kids at that time. And when they started seeing the things on TV, see, one thing about this war, it's different than other wars, immediate feedback. Probably doctored up a little bit, but people being murdered and they'd seem in the, you know, blown apart. And so it was more, every night you saw it and you heard the numbers. And so it was much more, it came home much more rapidly than in past wars. Even Korea didn't have that immediate feedback.
So was, as far as the student response to the war, I mean, what were there changes in the way they dressed and the way their hairstyle was, or?
I think there were changes for both students and for staff. We went out and looked at the yearbooks today, and it was reflective in the difference between the class of, say, 1967 and the class of 1970, and how the students looked and how the staff looked. And we recall when students first began to wear their hair long, boy students began to wear their hair long, and in 1968-69, that was an issue at school, and some students were suspended, almost expelled, I think, the one student for wearing his hair long. We had a teacher who decided to grow a beard, and the school board at the time said no beards. And so the teacher instead of shaving the beard, shaved just his chin and said he had long sideburns. But it was reflective of the mood of the country and the rebellion against authority. It was later, it was probably 1971 before we actually saw what I would call protests about the war. So the early things were more the reflection of what was going on in society as people became more disenchanted with government, largely due to our involvement in the war.
We talked about the dress, and we're all aware now that dress codes are a little laxed. We used to have pretty strict dress codes. And one thing that happened to students was they weren't passive learners. You know, they didn't accept everything. All of a sudden, we had to explain everything, give reasons for it. Why? The overall look, it's not a grunge look, but it was sort of a rebellion to what they used to have to live by, those kind of codes. And besides the long hair, the music changed. There was a lot of anti-war music. Simon Garfunkel had some, War was a big song, What Is It Good For? Absolutely nothing, and so on. So you had a lot of that kind of infiltration. And a lot of kids basically changed their view on their role as passive learners and became extremely active learners. There were two big protests. In 68, there was a big protest in Washington against the war. And in 72, March of 72, there was a huge protest. And Bob, Mr. Arm will tell you, or I will for him, I guess, that a lot of kids, even though they weren't protesting in Hillsborough, wanted to go into Portland for the big protest. And at that time, we had closed campus, and that was another big issue because that just came in. And to check kids out, well, we did let the kids go so they could protest in Portland because it was a national protest which had ramifications, in all the big cities. So our kids were involved. They got to go into the protests. And the big question was excused or non-excused absence of Bob Day. Of course, we at that time we did excuse them. But they were actively involved, but not much around here. Not a lot of outward agitation for the war, a lot of fear. I think kids feared what was going on, and this community at that time was much more conservative, so there was much more support, I would say, in general for the war, and so you didn't see that, the California type of response or the Kent State response to those things.
Were teachers and staff teaching about the war as it was going on?
Yeah, they were teaching about the war as it went on, especially here in Oregon. It went back, one of the main commentators on the war was Senator Wayne Morris, of course, and he was the only one in the Senate at the time that on the Bay of Tonkin resolution that voted against it. And so the war was very much in the Oregonians' minds as well as on the mass media and on TV. And to take another look at the situation, one thing that the kids, as Phil said, some of the kids, most of them stayed away from Portland, but it would only take one or two pretty sharp kids to go into Portland and come back. And at noontime, they would have their own little rally on campus and to get a lot of them going, and that started to occur more and more and more. And some of the protest marches, some of them were sanctioned, and then but many of them were not. You'd find that it'd be in the headlines of the paper or in the first or second page, you'd see this group did this against the war, this group did that in protest, and a lot of those situations were difficult at school because some of them on the sanctioned one, as Phil said, we did permit them to go, but the other ones we didn't, and then we got into a problem of being at school or not being at school, and some of the kids not so much took advantage of it, but just were looking for an excuse. It was kind of a frustrating time for kids. They saw on TV that night what happened that day. They read in the papers, but yet it hadn't really happened to them, but it was coming close.
I was teaching a course called American Problems or Modern Problems, and we taught about the war quite a bit. And the interesting thing, I think, again, Phil spoke to the fact that this was a pretty conservative community. There was debate. Not everybody was against the war. I think that, particularly when I first started teaching here, I would say that it was probably the other way. People were not so much supporting it, but they weren't against it. I think each year as the war went on and as our young people became involved, the feeling against the war grew and our students became more vocal about that. But we had debates in class, you know, and it was a pretty emotional time for people to talk about the war.
Another thing that kids saw that was interesting, but you turn on TV and you see the big rallies in Berkeley, California, and those types of things going on, or the Kent State, those types of issues where students were being shot by the National Guard in protest. And so kids got a sense that, and they had to be a part of it. And I imagine there's a lot of infighting in families where the kid would be against the war because their views, they were on the firing line, the parent wasn't, and you know, they started questioning patriotism. For a long time, when we started sending troops over, we always thought we were winning. You know, we never understood the guerrilla war impact and how to fight a guerrilla war. We didn't understand their culture, which we still don't as far as fighting wars. We were very poor of understanding somebody else's culture. And so we always felt we were winning. And it was sort of like Korea. But in 1968, what became known as the Tet Offensive, which is their Tet New Year, in 68 we thought we were winning, and they were moving back, the Viet Cong, and they all of a sudden counterattacked. And they really basically, you know, slaughtered us and just drove us back. So in 73, when we withdraw, we had no more territory than when we started back in, you know, 1964. And all of a sudden, people now started protesting against the war. They saw that it wasn't, hey, we're winning and, you know, we're fighting for good and Ho Chi Minh is evil. That became sort of, it was turned around. Now we're getting beat and we're getting slaughtered and so forth. So now there's a lot more outcry against the war, much more of a, hey, what are we here for? Questioning why we're here. Like in the past, World War II, they didn't question that. Now there's the questioning attitude. And do I go? Do I go to Canada? What are the things I do to get out of this? And a personal note, I was drafted and went in 1969. And they drafted me in April. I've been teaching for a year, and I finally appealed, and I got two more months off. But a lot of, and I was 25, and I've been teaching 2 years, and I got drafted, and I went to draft board to appeal my case. And, you know, I had allergies and all these things, and I was teaching, didn't make any difference. And I tell the story, I was next to a self-ordained teacher that went around door to door.
Preacher.
And they let him off. And I was, you know, really upset by this. But it was really a difficult time for me. It was a frightening time, you know, to go. Didn't want to, obviously. There's a lot of questions in your mind about why are we there. And I think that's the big thing that's different than in all of the wars. We questioned why we were there. And really, there were no good answers why we were there. Because, as you know, Vietnam sort of grows out of the French in World War II.
So how much exactly of the changes that actually happened do you think could be attributed to the war rather than other issues that were going on at the time, like civil rights, for example?
I think it's hard to separate the two. I think it's very difficult to separate what was happening with civil rights and what was happening with the war, because they fed on each other. You know, one group protesting the war, another group protesting racism, fed on each other's movement. And I think that it created a climate in most communities, and ours perhaps less than many, but in most communities it created a climate of that willingness to speak out against those things that before you hardly ever talked about. And we had, you know, Bob, maybe you can talk a little bit too about, we had some specific things on the Hill High campus. I know we had some kids wear black armbands, but I can't remember exactly why that was.
But I remember a couple things. I don't remember that either, but I remember a couple things that as I said before, there were some student leaders or students who assumed the role of leaders on campus, and they held, several times a week. They would have meetings, and they would get at noontime. They would be in the pit, and they would have their causes, and some of it, they would stand up and say the different things. And as far as the civil rights are concerned, this is the first time that one of the major wars that blacks really were involved to a much higher degree in Vietnam than they had been in any other war, and that really rode the truth home as far as being a civil rights. We're here, we're dying, we're living, and we're doing the same thing as everyone else, but yet our numbers are proportionally, they were very high.
And of course, in Hillsborough at that time, we were basically a Caucasian community. We had very few minorities. I think maybe we had one black student, and that was a foreign exchange student. So we were a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant community in a sense. I mean, Catholic, Mormon, whatever too, but we were a white community, so we didn't see that actual racial tension so much in our community at that time. But like I said, I think it was all tied together as far as, and what you read in the paper, our students were very interested in what we were reading in the paper or in Time magazine or seeing the pictures. And as we had people come back from the war, such as this young man you brought the article, and this is the one I was talking about, as those people returned from the war, the talk increased. And I think for me, one of the saddest things about this was that these kinds of tragedies. We had another student, probably, I think he graduated in 71 or 72, and he went to Vietnam. He came back. He wasn't wounded in Vietnam, but he also committed suicide, and he couldn't live with what he had seen, with the terrible deaths and atrocities that he'd seen. And his father was a doctor here, and it was, so we saw that as those things began to happen, I think that whether it was civil rights happening in Selma, Alabama, or whether it was civil rights happening in Portland, our students were now more in tune to that.
What do you know about the draft, the whole, the law, the board, what was?
The initial draft when the war began and up until 1970 was that you registered for the draft and you were classified. And you could be classified for a variety of reasons, but if you were 1A, that meant that you were draftable. And everybody who was 1A, basically after a while, after the Tet Offensive, everybody was drafted in one way or another. And a lot of my friends went to National Guard. They had that choice if they could get in. And so a lot of my friends did that, and they didn't go be a U.S., so to speak. That's what they called them, U.S. They were drafted. And those kids registered, went, and some people who were maybe had some kind of debilitating illness, or they could get out for if they had kids, or if they had, they're in a critical industry and so forth. But most people my age didn't get deferments for college, even though they tried. And I was teaching, and it didn't make any difference. Once I got in, and if you made it to 26, by the way, you escaped. And I was 25 something, so I didn't quite make it. Once I got in, then in the very near future, they changed the draft to a lottery system. And that was, if you're classified 1A or whatever, draftable, then your birthday was selected. And if you were, let's say, January 8th or the first one, then you were number one. And of course, then you're drafted. I think I was, my number came at 250-some, so I wouldn't have been drafted if I had another 6 months. But then it changed. And you got, then you went, As a draft changed, you went from, after the war, from a drafting status to a volunteer army. So the quality of military people went up, because they were taking everybody. You know how that works. If you take everybody, you get what you deserve. And so there's a lot of problems with the intelligence of people and be able to function in a military environment. And so that really changed. After the war, they went to a civilian army. And so the draft went away, and the quality of people you have in the Army goes up because it's your choice to go instead of being drafted.
Another thing that goes along with this is that I have a twin brother, and we both had the same draft board, but we lived in different areas, and I was drafted and he wasn't. He got a deferment. He was teaching and I was teaching, but we're in two different communities, and we're the same age, of course, and he stayed, and then I was drafted, and a week before I was to go to camp or to boot training, I was able to enlist in the National Guard, and I was in for 6 years at that time. I went through this basic training, the 6 months basic training down at Fort Ord with everyone else, but then we came back. But it was as again, as Mr. Barnacle said, it's frustrating because what was good for one wasn't the same thing for anyone else. I mean, it was just almost like fate, really. And I never did get a number. I was a couple years older.
So were there any young men who openly resisted the draft or ran away from it, or?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure that young people, I know a lot of people that I knew from high school were heavily into the protest movement, and one of the things was to try to go to Canada, and that was an issue. Out here, even though I'm sure kids resented it and so forth, there wasn't that, I didn't hear any outward, I mean, there's fear, we hate the war, but I didn't see or hear much of kids leaving school and running to Canada. You know, they protested, so forth. I just don't think at that point in this community versus Portland, some of the more liberal areas, that there was that kind of response. I think they rallied, they learned about it, they saw what was going on, they protested. But I would maintain, and this is a guess, that most of the kids were drafted probably went, and as Marianne said, some of them even enlisted because that was the thing to do. And remember, the war, when they enlisted, they believed in just cause. You know, and when Nixon said a just and honorable peace or whatever it was, and of course that became the big cliche, which it wasn't, because things had changed. So war is never good. War solves nothing. But people thought of World War II as a justifiable war. They saw Korea as protecting our outer boundaries, even though it wasn't. And then Vietnam came, and all of a sudden we learned a different lesson, that we weren't always right, that we weren't the policemen of the world, and we made mistakes, and we were in the wrong place. And so that changed. I think that was the biggest change of this country, is we were now looking at what... how can we justify what we're doing to people? And of course, the Nixon doctrine said we'd never get involved in Southeast Asia or anyplace else. Of course, that went down the drain, and we did get involved. And we're still feeling the effects of the war and how to deal with cultures that we don't understand. If you look at the Middle East and so forth, we're having the same problem. We don't understand those cultures and how to deal with some of those issues that are so overlapping. And so, big change.
The one thing to go along with that really, if one really stops, and Phil mentioned this earlier to a degree, but we were really fighting a people. They didn't have an organized Navy. They had no Air Force whatsoever. They didn't have a uniform that they put on every day. They had a gun. They had a package of rice. There wasn't any system of support as far as health, hospitals, and food in the field for them, but yet they had shovels and they had tunnels and they were winning. And we had a huge Air Force at the time. We had a huge Navy involved. We had a massive support system in food and munitions and supplies, and we were barely holding our own. And many times we weren't. We did.
So how were the returning veterans treated when they got back from the war?
I think, you know, some of them were treated like Terry Haig was, as a hero, you know, and as a tragedy, but a hero nevertheless. But I think that if you speak to them after the fact, and it may not be that it was so noticeable immediately in our community, but if you speak to them after the fact, many of them feel like they never received a hero's welcome, and yet they did what their country had asked them to do. And I think that if you go back to Washington, D.C., and you see the Vietnam Memorial, and you read the history of how that memorial came about, that's exactly why that memorial is there, because those Vietnam veterans, I mean, you would talk to them and they would have tears in their eyes because they felt like they went off and fought for their country, but they didn't come home to a hero's welcome. They came home to a country that was divided on the issue of whether they should have ever been there or not. And increasingly, the tide was turning that they shouldn't have been there. And of course, Bob spoke to the kind of war it was, and Phil spoke to the kind of war it was. I'm sure you've read recently about Mr. Kerry, former Senator Kerry, and you know what has come out about his role in Vietnam. Well, those things were surfacing gradually, and I don't put the blame on Kerry or any of the other men who were there. It was that kind of war where the enemy didn't wear a uniform and you didn't know who it was, but the result was atrocious. You know, the result was just terrible on both sides. On both sides.
You know, I think that one thing that besides the resentment of why we were there, we also learned for the first time that we could be as malicious as the enemy. We always thought the enemy was always malicious and they were slaughtering us. Well, we found out through the My Lai massacre that we also had brutalized civilians. And I think one thing we still never have learned is that war, that's one of the things that comes with war. That's why war is bad. You can't assume that there's rules for war. And civilians, if you look at the number of people killed in a war that are military versus total number of people, the majority of people killed in war are civilians. And so, but now we could see that. We saw the My Lai massacre. We saw the death of those people. We saw the trial of Callie and all these people. And so war took on a different meaning. And so when these people came home, they didn't get any awards like the GI Bill, you know, after World War II or after Korea. There was nothing. They came back, no jobs, nobody cared about them, and they weren't supported because now the war, remember, was negative. Why are we there? Are 38,000 people, young people killed versus 400 and some odd thousand wounded and maimed. So what for? Well, it didn't have any meaning to the country. I'm sure some people felt we were justified, but the longer the war went, and finally we ended up at the Treaty of Paris pulling out, and for what it, we got nothing out of it. We didn't win. We actually lost. And in this country, when you lose war, that was a different feeling. And so these people lost. So they come back. They're not heroes because they didn't win. There's no noble cause. Matter of fact, we went over and brutalized the people in their country for no reason. You know, if we weren't there, what was that going to do to us strategically? And of course, we were still fighting through those people, the Cold War, which was still going. I think you know that Ho Chi Minh, which is a real interesting, if you I know you studied that, that Ho Chi Minh we supported during World War II. He was fighting against the Japanese in Indochina at the time, and we supported him because he was the person who was stopping them. And after the war, after Dien Bien Phu and the French, then he became, quote, a communist, driving the French out, the imperialists. So all of a sudden, communism became a negative, and anybody who was communist, we were against. We supported dictators, everybody else, but if you're communist, we were against you. And so Ho Chi Minh, who we did support, now became our enemy. And basically, the country, most of those people, even though it was a divided country at that time, supported him.
Just to say one more thing about how about the people returning, Bob mentioned that the large number of African Americans who were in this war, probably they had as much resentment as anybody when they came back, because not only were they not heroes, but they came back to a country that still hadn't fully enfranchised them. They were still not recognized as full worthy citizens in much of the United States. And so they had kind of a double whammy, so to speak, to have been in the war and to have been, as Phil said, not returning as a hero, but then to return to the same old civil rights issues and discrimination and prejudices and biases that were there before they went.
Was there anything I haven't mentioned yet that you'd like to tell?
No, I think you've covered the bases, and a lot of things in those periods of time change, and even though you're involved in it, sometimes it's hard to see the forest through the trees, even though I think that a lot of things have changed because of the war and civil rights, and they're all tied together. And one thing that didn't really reflect in Hillsborough, but may have, which happened, I was in Portland going to school, as Bob did, we had kids drafted and going in as early as 61. And many of my friends in 61, 62, I can remember their names better than the ones I can in Hillsborough, were dead before I'd even graduated. And one of the things is we had a lot of Oriental people. One of my good friends was named Grant Hanjoji. He had a big article in the paper a while ago. And he had to go over. He was drafted. And he, you can imagine the conflict going to a country where you look not only like the enemy, but also like, you know, somebody on your own side. And he ended up getting killed and not returning. So that was another issue, because we had the Oriental in an Oriental country. And so there's a lot of mental battles going on, I'm sure, in their mind. But it got escalated to 68, and that's why we talk about it. But a lot of people were being killed of our friends in 61 and 62. So we, when I came out to Hillsborough and it hit, it already hit some of the older people, because, you know, the war had been going on since Eisenhower started sending in people in the 50s. So, you know, I think that the changes that happened in that war are still around. We're still fighting that war, as you know. We see Kerry and those things are still coming out. So that war probably had a bigger impact on society, not necessarily positive, as any war, because it changed how we think about war, how we perceive ourselves in the world, and people now question. And one thing that we said, that the biggest things for us as teachers, now you had to explain everything, those damn kids. Mm-hmm. Why is this? Why is that? And most of that, when we were teaching, was current events, because we didn't understand a lot of what was going on either, how we got there. So we were learning. So it was current events. So we were exchanging views. And teachers were, the liberal teachers with their beards and stuff, they were talking about getting out, and the conservative teachers saying, oh no. So there's a lot of infighting in the social studies department. But I'll tell you, there was the liberal and the conservatives, and you wave the flag and I'm taking the flag and burn it. It was just it wasn't just kids, it was society as a whole. And before, there was no, the other words, unified front, you know, wave the flag, it changed. And I think that still, we question now why we're where we're at, and is that where we want to be?
I think for me, and I agree with Phil, it started long before the late 60s, because when I was in college, many of my friends were drafted, and some came home and some didn't. I have never been able to go to a movie on Vietnam. I've seen tons of movies about World War II and movies about World War I and the French Revolution and everything else. I have never been able to go to one of the movies made about Vietnam, and I don't think that I ever will.
Looking back and listening to what Phil said and Marianne, one of the things that they say that you get out of a war is you get lessons, but far too often we don't take the time to really delve into the lessons in that. And one of the things that comes to my mind is that regardless of its Republican or Democratic administrations, the last ones or the present one, but we really have to, as Mr. Barnikoff pointed out, we really have to take a strong look and respect toward the other nations. We're looking at China right now today. This project could be a project of two kids sitting here 20 years from now wanting to know, how did we get involved in China? What we don't know what the future is. We could be taking a look at the Israeli Arab thing. If that ends up the way to it, it could be all the Arabs and all the Arab nations against Israel. We don't know where that's going to be. So in your future reflections, you really have to take a look and respect and take a long, long, strong look at something before you really decide, and be interested in the news. Take a look at it all the time because it's there.
One last comment, which I think we have learned. If you look at Kosovo and those places, the one thing you always hear whenever we go or think we're going or send troops, we don't want another Vietnam, an entangling alliance. So you always hear that. We don't want another Vietnam. So we do reflect. So we just don't say go hell-bent for election and run in with our troops. Because we've learned that military power doesn't necessarily mean you win. Because when you're fighting on somebody else's land, they have the advantage. They have the home court advantage. And we've learned that. As Bob said, we would watch the bombers napalm a whole jungle. The bridges would disappear. Within a week, the bridges would be back, the trails would be open, and they'd be remined. And one thing that we learned as a military policeman was, and we didn't learn it for a while, is when you went out in the morning in Vietnam along a trail, you never came back the same trail. And you can understand why, because once you went out, they'd mine it. And that took us a long time to learn those lessons, because we were sort of naive about how to fight guerrilla warfare. We never understood that. And so we were at a disadvantage. We still don't know how to fight a guerrilla war because, you know, we figure that air power and naval power and napalm, and it didn't work. So I think one thing that we have learned, and maybe it's not a complete lesson, is we've learned that we don't want to be back in that same type of situation where we're entangled in something that we can't get out of. Because, see, we couldn't get out until finally somebody had the guts. Yeah, but until you had somebody like MacArthur and McGovern, the people who said, we've got to get out, we're wrong. And that's when Nixon, of course, you know, sort of had to fold and throw his cards in and suck them up. And so, big lesson for this country.
Well, it was also, speaking of the withdrawal, it was also draining us economically. Understand that that's perhaps something we haven't talked about. The effect on the economy in this nation was noticeable everywhere. You probably read last year's report that the students did on the strike. Well, part of that was directly related, believe it or not, to the economy of the state and the nation. And teachers had never gone on strike before, but now money was tied everywhere. And the economy suffered that was a drain. We couldn't have guns and butter, as the saying goes. We simply couldn't have guns and butter, and we were pouring huge amounts of money into that war and not doing what we needed to do domestically. And the morale was very low. The morale was very low, everything. So that was another, perhaps, lesson that we learned.
All right, well, that concludes this interview.